We are now recording for Q&A, and welcome to everybody who has stuck around. We're at 37 at this point, and I'm going to mute all with the allow participants to unmute themselves. So, Alan, you'll want to unmute yourself. So, folks, feel free to either enter stuff into the chat window or unmute yourself at any point if you want to comment or ask a question or whatever as we go through Q&A. Feel free to do so. And with that, I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. As usual, we have a number of different items on the agenda. So we'll kick off with a follow-up from last week. And you may recall that Natalie was asking about alternatives for Microsoft Office, in fact, three alternatives. Stuart suggested a couple of things. One was Android Office, and another one was the Office Suite, but for Android. And it turns out that Office Suite for Android is a full version in that you can edit files and that kind of thing. It's not just the reader. So the two URLs are there if anybody wants to run Office on their Android phone or tablet. And my brother-in-law, Bill, who I think is still on the call, said that he's been using WP Office on his tablet for quite a while, and it works very well also. And when I looked, it turns out that there is now a PC version of WPS Office. So for Windows, you can try that if you don't like the LibreOffice, which I had suggested. So there's some office alternatives for you to think about for both phones and tablets, Android devices, and also for regular Windows PCs. Interesting, we had this conversation about Wi-Fi because a friend of mine had a problem that the wireless card on her laptop gave up the ghost. And of course, when the thing breaks, what you can do is take it into the shop and have it fixed for enormous amounts of money in terms of labor generally. But the other thing you can do is, as was suggested earlier, buy a Wi-Fi dongle. So that's exactly what I told her to do. I looked one up at Canada Computers, and for $9.99 plus tax, and she went and bought this little TP-Link micro dongle, nano plug they call it. And these are really neat because if you have a laptop with a spare USB port, you can just plug it in. It's only the little black bit that sticks out, maybe 3/8, quarter of an inch. So you can leave it plugged in all the time. And apparently it worked perfectly, so we have a happy camper for $10. One of the things we started off last week too was this idea of smart applications for Android phones and tablets. And I was asking what are your favorites. And I said it could also be a regular PC program. And a number of people took me up on this, so we have two or three different smart applications, starting off with a suggestion from Chris.
Yeah, I've been long an advocate of using a password manager to manage the dozens, hundreds of passwords that I have, as well as other personal information and so forth that I want kept safe. And so I use KeePass Droid, which is on my phone, because it's a port of the KeePass that is available on desktop computers. And it uses the same database, so I can actually manage my password database between multiple devices. So I have a screenshot there just that was taken from the KeePass website, just showing how it looks. And so on the left-hand side, you see at the top, you can have groups of things if you wanted to categorize them. And then down below that, where you see just the globes, those are actual individual entries in the password database. And the right-hand one shows you the particular entries for one of the applications. You have the places for name, username, the URL of the site, your password, and any other information that you put into a comments field and so forth. So it's really kind of a nice application. Next slide. So as I say, the database is identical between the two of them. And what I find really handy is to synchronize the password database between my desktop computers and my phone. And at the March meeting, I will be giving a presentation on using KeePass. And part of the presentation will be talking about how to set up that synchronization of your password database. Interestingly, the KeePass has a lot of ports available, including things like Chrome OS and Linux and Mac OS, iOS for phones from Apple or tablets from Apple. They even have a port for BlackBerry, if anybody still has one around, or going back even more, Palm OS, Windows Phone, which is long defunct. And they even have a command line interface using Perl scripting that you can actually open up your password database using Perl. So for people that want really bizarre access to your KeePass database, I doubt if you can find a device that it won't work with.
There's a question in the chat, Chris, about password managers, the downside possibly. Aren't you giving all your passwords to a private company?
Ooh. No, I'm giving my password database to anybody who wants it. If anybody wants a copy of it, I'll email you a copy of it. I have no fear because it has an extremely strong password on that, and it is encrypted with AES encryption, and I have no fear that anybody who gets a hold of that file will actually be able to make any sense of it.
And I guess what she was thinking was you're storing the database in the cloud, but yep. KeePass doesn't do that, right?
Well, by itself, it will let you put it anywhere you want. It's just a file. I put it in the cloud because that allows me to do an easy synchronization through Google Drive, because I can synchronize my phone to a file that's stored in Google Drive, and I can synchronize my desktop to a file that exists in my Google Drive. So I definitely store it in the cloud. And as I say, I have no fear because it is very strongly encrypted with a long, complex password that nobody is about to crack in less than centuries of time. And I won't be around at that point, so I don't care.
And I have an encrypted database that I don't put in the cloud. So it's on my local computer, which is one of the reasons I use KeePass.
Yeah. If you are afraid of that, there are ways of manually synchronizing the KeePass database between devices. You just have to somehow get that file from one device to the other. I find it easier to do it as an automatic synchronization, but if you don't want to store it in the cloud, you could do it as a manual synchronization.
Kareem's saying it still requires you to record the password to KeePass in case something happens to you and you're unable to act due to incapacity.
No, I'll remember it. The idea of giving it to other people, point taken on that. I do have it available in the password to my KeePass database. It's in a very secure location, and a couple of people know where it is, that in the event of incapacitance or death, they could access that. But other than that, it's the one password that I have to remember. And I'm in it, on an almost daily basis. So I'm not about to forget it.
Okay. So, moving on, thinking about clearing the cache to, clean up space on a phone that doesn't have a huge amount of memory. And it turns out that older versions of Android, pre-version 5, which was Lollipop, they had a setting that let you clear the cache for all the apps in one operation. So you could go to settings, storage, devices, cache data, and then clear cache data. And that would get rid of all of the cache data. And cache data, of course, you can get rid of because any app that needs it, rather than read it from the cache, will just regenerate it from the original source. So you can clear out space that way with no difficulty. The problem is that newer versions of Android, like my phone is running Android 6, and doesn't let you do that. So I can either go into the settings and pick up individual apps and then clear the cache for the browser and the email program and, you know, whatever else I've been using to try and free up space. Or I could try and find one of my famous smart apps that will do the job. And of course, the problem is as soon as you put in a search like cache cleaner into the Play Store, you get, 72 apps to choose from. And then the question is, well, which one do you want? So you have to go onto the web and check out reviews and find out which are good programs and which are maybe not so good programs. And almost the first one I ran into was CC Cleaner. And one of the advantages of that is that I've used this program previously because it's a PC version to clean up Windows. And so it's kind of an old friend, and it actually gets really, really good reviews. And they say it's easy to use and that it's very powerful. One of the good things or the bad things, depending how you look at it, is it has multiple tools. So it's not just the cache cleaner. It will clean the cache, get rid of any downloaded files, clear all the histories from your various browsers, any clipboard content, etc., etc. But it also has features where you can remove unwanted applications, unused applications, for example. And it has monitors for things like the amount of processor usage, the amount of memory, and how the battery is performing. So if you want a tool suite, that's fine. But if you only want the cache cleaner, that's not so good. Turns out it is very easy to use. And the first time I used it, it found 350 gigabytes of cache data. So that was good. But basically, it shows you how much you've got to available to clean. I've only got 3 megabytes here. And then when you click on the quick clean, then it goes off and cleans up its junk files. And of course, this is a free program, so it's ad supported. So you can see, if you want to buy electrical lighting equipment, you can go to the store on Innes Road and buy yourself some LED lights. The other thing you can do is when you tell it to clean, it will show you what it's going to clean. So it says it found some hidden cache and it found some visible cache. It also offers to clean up empty folders if you want. And then you can, on the right hand side here where I've got the arrow, the circle rather, you can see there's a drop down. So if I click on that drop down, then it will basically tell me where all the various files are in the hidden cache. So I've got some in the Play Store, some in the Site Finder app, etc. So then I can just hit the finish cleaning button and it will delete all of the above. So I thought that was fine and dandy. It worked really well. But then a few days later, I start getting these notifications popping up. Apparently I haven't used the Toronto Dominion Bank app for a while. In fact, I don't think I've ever used it. Maybe I've used it once. But I certainly hadn't used it for a while. And so it's suggesting that, well, you haven't used it, so you can get rid of this one. Now there's a problem for me because I like apps that do what I tell them to do. I tell them, go look at the cache, see what's available. And if I like it, then clean it. But don't come bugging me every 2 minutes that you can do this or you can do that for me. And that's too intrusive. And the other thing is, notice down here, the program itself is taking 122 megabytes of internal storage, my precious memory. So it's bugging me because it's got all these extra features and it's taking up all this space, which I'm trying to create. So I found out that if I press this button right here called uninstall, I can get 122 megabytes back and I don't have people bugging me all the time. So personally, I'm looking for a small app that cleans the cache and that's basically all it does. So if anybody has any bright ideas for that, let me know. All right.
Before you leave there, Google actually does a fairly good job. Mind you, I have a Pixel, so maybe that makes a difference. But you can go into Google and it'll delete things automatically, slow down things, and just go into your settings and take a look. There's a lot of controls you can use right there to reduce your memory footprint and background apps.
Yeah, it's very dependent on the phone and the version of Android. And my Android doesn't do that by itself. Okay, so Stuart had a suggestion. You want to unmute yourself, Stuart? You're going to talk about this thing. Where is he? There he is. You must be muted. Stuart, you're muted. Still muted.
Yeah, on the...
I think I got it that time.
There we go.
So I'm supposed to talk now. Okay, yeah, I found this... little app in a article somewhere, you know, the web, that big place where you find all kinds of stuff. And it's a very simple, basic survey application from Google itself that will give you credit on the Google Play Store. So you get a few pennies or maybe a few more pennies every time you do a little survey, which are usually very simple, two or three questions. You don't have to do them. If you finish the surveys, the credit is good for 1 year from the finishing the survey, and they accumulate. Now, you can only use this money on the Google Play Store, which for me is great because there's a whole bunch of apps there that I'm too cheap to pay for, but I wouldn't mind getting the registered or paid version of. So that's going to work for me. And if you're not into apps, paid apps, well, there's all kinds of esoteric stuff like books and music that you could use the credit for as well. So that's about it.
So when you say use it for paid apps, these don't have to be Google apps. They can be like third-party apps, the $1.99 thing. You can use your credit to buy that.
Well, as long as it's on the Play Store, I would assume.
Okay. That's good.
Play Store credit.
Okay, perfect. Thanks very much, Stuart.
Welcome.
Okay, so a couple of questions came in. One was about Chrome. This is from Enid. She's taking a language course with the Otto Carlton School Board, but has never been able to log into their website to get the class handouts. And their tech support people suggested that she should delete all the cookies on her computer and use an incognito tab, private browser tab in Chrome. And she wants to know how to do these things. And we happen to have a guru, a Chrome guru, don't we, Chris?
I do not know if I would consider myself a Chrome guru. One of the things I will say up front, actually, is that be careful with anybody who says delete all your cookies. It can erase some more information than perhaps you really want to. As a general rule, cookies shouldn't be evil or anything like that. However, incognito mode is probably the better one to start with. But if you want to clear your cache, which is always a good thing, and a cache that is too large can definitely end up causing you problems under certain circumstances where it won't load pages properly. So in Chrome, you click on the three dots that are in the top right-hand corner of the screen, and you choose Settings, and then you go to Privacy and Security section, and there's a thing to clear browsing data. And there will be a couple of checkboxes in there. I suggest that you clear all of the boxes except for cached images and files and then clear data. and try that. Or you could use CCleaner, which can keep all of your different browsers you use. It can clean out the caches in one fell swoop, which is what I do. And periodically, CCleaner will pop up saying that it can free up 1.5 gigabytes of stuff on my computer. I just tell it, analyze it, make sure it's not deleting something I don't want deleted, and then I click on go, and it takes care of it. So that's clearing the cache. The incognito mode, you can press Control-Shift-N in Chrome, or if you go and click the three dots in the top right, you'll have an option for new incognito window. And so you could try that out.
And Natalie's commenting that she has the browser set to clear the cache every time she closes it.
Okay. Yeah, so that's obviously not your issue. So you could try incognito mode, see if that does it. The idea of clearing out cookies, I don't know. I really don't like to clear all my cookies because it is the one way that websites know you from click to click or session to session. And there could be some personalizations in there that you end up getting rid of if you clear all your cookies.
That's certainly true. If they store the username when you for logon credentials, for example, if you clear all the cookies, then next time you log on, it won't remember your username.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But it's no big deal. I mean, you just enter it and then it sets a new cookie. So
yeah.
Big deal. Okay, next question is from Peggy. This message popped up on her screen, Microsoft account problem. We need to fix your Microsoft account. And we had this discussion back in August, but we didn't really have any great suggestions on how to actually fix it. And that's exactly what Peggy wants to know. What's the problem and why does Microsoft want me to fix it? I wanted to disregard it, but it kept coming back, and that's the problem right there. It keeps coming back. So there are three possible fixes we have. And last time we said, basically just fix the problem the way they say. So it suggests to go to user experience or something. So just follow the bouncing ball, do what it says, and see if that makes everything go away. Another suggestion was to, as Bob Walker had talked about earlier, if you set up a Microsoft account when you log on to Windows, you can have this problem that Microsoft now knows about you and comes and bugs you. But the problem is, of course, once you've set up your Windows system, however you did it, you're kind of stuck with it. But you can change things. So one of the suggestions here is to switch the Microsoft account that you use to log on to a local account. And if you go to this How to Geek webpage, it will tell you how to do that. And the third way is kind of a variant on that. One is to create a local account if you don't already have one, and then just remove the Microsoft account entirely. So now you're logging on with a regular username and password, let's say, local account, and you're not going to have this problem with Microsoft anymore. But Chris has a number of caveats on that, so I'll let him speak to that.
Yeah, the Microsoft really pushes people to be using a Microsoft account, and there are certain integration features that take advantage of the fact that you're using a Microsoft account. I think, I can't remember all of the ones it is. I think one of the things is if you're getting apps through the Microsoft Store, when you're downloading apps, you are automatically logged into the store. If you're on a local account, it doesn't happen, and so you have to log into the Microsoft Store manually using a Microsoft account and to use that. Quick Assist, I think if you're assisting other people, again, you'd have to log in manually if you're not using a Microsoft account to log into Windows.
A correction.
Sorry?
You don't have to log in to download stuff from the Microsoft Store.
Oh, really? I thought you had to be logged in. That's really odd. Interesting. Okay. But there are some integration features for sure that are going to come into play. And there are some password recovery options that can help you out if you are using a Microsoft account that don't come into play if you're using a local account. To my mind, I like to use local accounts all the time. I don't care about all those integration features. And so I just use a local account. But just be aware of the fact that there are some integration features that you will lose if you're using a local account. If you are switching from using a Microsoft account to log into Windows and going to a local account, I highly recommend that you make sure that you have a local account set up on your computer that is administrator access. I've often advocated this for recovery purposes. It can be a godsend to have a local account that is administrator. I call it rescue on my computer, and I can log into that at any time. So make sure you have that account set up and tested before you actually change your Microsoft account to being a local account. I've never heard of anything going wrong, but I wouldn't want to be the first. And so this will allow you to rescue things in the event that something does go wrong.
Okay, so that's the end of the prepared deck. I saw a lot of comments in the chat about various applications. So I just kind of say two things. If you want to create a couple of slides, the slide that Chris had, for example, on his free Droid item, he actually sent me a couple of PowerPoint slides, so I just put those into the deck. And Stuart sent me an email with the details of the money-grabbing, whatever it was called. So I created a couple of slides from that. So if people have suggestions for applications, say, for next week, if you want to do that, send me two or three PowerPoint slides, or send me some information, and I'll create the slide, and you can just talk to me. So, do we have any other questions? I haven't checked the chat window to see if there were any.
There was one from Claudette asking, what are the health implications of Wi-Fi signals? How concerned should we be? And Tom answered that radio waves are non-ionizing, so the only effect is heating, like microwave, and Wi-Fi is so weak that there's no problem. I'm just looking through. We have a lot of comments. Yeah, a lot of people did put in some suggestions to apps, so certainly people can pick up the chat tonight or after later tonight. Alan will have this posted, and you could check out the other links that people have provided to other interesting apps and so forth.
There is one suggestion I'd like to make that needs more explanation, I guess, and that's that if you use an Android device and so you have Chrome as the default browser, if you actually install another browser like Firefox, I use Firefox nightly, which is an adventure, you can actually have ads deleted and stuff like that from that other browser. And then if you disable Chrome, you can't actually uninstall Chrome from an Android device, but you can disable it. And then whenever you open a page, you can it goes to the Firefox, in my case, or whatever other browser you choose that can avoid the ads that Chrome always has.
Interesting. Yeah. Eldon Goss sent me a direct message. Has anyone had any experience with Restoro, R-E-S-T-O-R-O. So if anybody has anything to say about that, please chime in. And Timothy asked me, does my Ignite box hum? And no, mine does not, at least not to a level that I've ever noticed it. And if you're talking about the main gateway box, that's about 2 feet away from me right now, and it definitely doesn't hum, and I'm pretty sure that the box that attaches to my TV doesn't hump either. So might want to check with Rogers on that as to why that might be the case.
I have Ignite and my main modem hums, and when I complained, they said it was the fan, the cooling fan, and I think perhaps that's true. But
it's interesting. I've never had a hum out of mine, but it's actually quite warm to the touch.
The box on the TV doesn't hum, but my main box right here. I really found it annoying at first. I think I've gotten used to it now, but.
Actually, if I put my ear right up to mine, I can hear a very, very slight sound. So, yeah, it might be a cooling fan then, and maybe mine is just a little quieter than yours.
One suggestion, if you have a hum from an electrical device, one thing I do, at least with older devices, is I take the plug and I reverse it. You can't really do this on new devices because they are polarized plugs with one plug being bigger. But if you have if the plug is the same on both sides of the prong, then reverse the plug, and then that may ground what is causing the hum and get rid of it.
Oh, cool. Never knew that. Let me try it right now. Bye.
Bye. Bye, Chris.
George has a question here. He says he has an old Dell E6420, and he's noticing that the power LED, the start, is blinking. Should this be a concern?
Isn't that the self-destruct mode?
I can type in here. This is an old laptop, this is the charging LED, and I had looked at the power supply with a voltmeter, and it's 19.5 volts, which is what it's supposed to be. So I guess the natural thing that could be going, or it would be the battery, right?
Yeah, that's what I would have guessed. Yeah.
What sort of action should I take?
My experience with batteries is if it gets to that point, it's beyond redemption. In order to keep a battery from getting to that condition prematurely, it's a good idea to not be always plugged into the power outlet. Mm-hmm. I had a laptop that was sat in a docking station, and after about a year, it wouldn't hold a charge at all. And since then, I did some research, and it seems to be a general recommendation that at least once a month to remove it from being on power, let it run down to about 25 or 30%, and then charge it up again. And just that will be enough to keep the battery conditioned. But my understanding is once it gets in a bad state, not an awful lot that you can do to recondition it. You might try taking it off of power, letting it run down to, about 20%, charge it all the way up, take it off, let it run down again, and do that several cycles. It might help. But I don't know an awful lot about batteries, so if anybody else on the call knows more about batteries, please chime in.
How old is your Dell?
Oh, it's probably 10 years.
Okay, yeah. It depends on the battery, what you can do with it.
Yeah.
If it's a lithium battery, then basically you could take it apart and actually put in new 18650s. It would be an adventure for you. It is possible, though. If it's and the same thing is true of an older battery with the NiCads or the nickel manganese. You can also take them apart and replace the cells, because they're usually standard cells, either double A's or the 18650s for the lithiums. Mm-hmm. Regarding batteries, there are several programs that you can use. On my Asus, I have one of the programs that governs the Asus allows me to set the state of charge of my battery. So I have it set for 60%. 60% is the ideal for a long lifespan. And in fact, on my phone, I have a program called AccuBattery that gives me an alarm when my phone gets up to 61% charged, and then I take it off the charger or unplug it, unless I need to go out or I need more battery life. And with regard to the Dell, it may or may not be available for your computer, but take a look on the Dell site and take a look at Battery Saver or something like that, because on my the computer I had before this was a Dell, and it worked sometimes to keep the battery set to 71 or 72%, I think. But it only came on and told me after I was charging it for ages and ages. So it was very inconsistent. But take a look on the Dell website.
And Justin's put a link to the Dell website, the support section, for a diagnostic and battery indicator page. So that might be a useful resource.
Also, you can often get, for common computers, you can often get replacement batteries on the web on eBay, if you take a look. They're usually rebuilt with new batteries.
Hmm. Natalie has a question. What's the optimal minimum percent for a phone battery before charging? I guess this would apply to any rechargeable batteries, I guess. Tom, do you have any idea? But I know you should never let it get down to zero. Is there an optimal minimal percentage before charging?
I'm not entirely sure. I believe it's 20%, and that's what I use. I have a smart watch, and it usually gives me an alarm when it gets down to about 10%, and then I put it on charge or turn it off. The main use for these things is when the battery is expensive or it's in a device where you can't really change the battery. And then if your device battery dies, your device dies, and there goes the price you paid for it, even though it's probably obsolete at that point.
Yeah.
I read somewhere recently that you should aim for between 10% and 90%, but that wasn't a scientific article, so I'd be dubious about those numbers.
Is there a risk in running the computer without a battery?
No, if it's plugged in, it works just fine, as my 10-year-old Dell can testify to.
Yeah, I've heard it depends. It's one of those things, universal answer for all IT-related questions, that depends. I have read that some manufacturers will warn you that it can damage the computer if you run it without the battery in place in the computer. So check with your manufacturer before you do that. It would be my recommendation.
One more thing. If you are storing devices away or batteries away, it's best to have them charged around 40%. That's usually how they're shipped to you, and apparently that's the sort of least damage for ongoing charge. Don't store them fully charged. Apparently dendrils grow and stuff like that that messes up the battery happen.
Oh, cool. Do you have any idea how long, if you're talking about long-term storage, Tom, do you have any idea about what we're talking about? Is it, if it's going to be stored over a week or over a month?
It probably doesn't matter over a week or two, but if it's going to be any longer than that, it's worthwhile setting it to that.
Okay.
If you're going away on vacation, I don't know. It all depends on how much you care about that battery.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, thanks. Okay, I think I've gone up and down in the questions a couple of times, and I don't think I missed anything, but if anybody did ask a question or make a comment that they thought was important, and we haven't talked about it verbally, please weigh in again, and I apologize for missing it. In looking through the chat, we had a lot of stuff in the chat tonight, which is great.
I have a question. It's Gail. Why should you not let your battery get down to zero?
I'm not sure the physics of it, but it does harm the overall life of the battery for it to going down to zero. It's not going to make it die right off the bat if it hits zero, but it will lessen the life of the battery over time. And so if you constantly do it, it will affect its ability to hold a full charge.
Thank you.
I don't know about computer batteries, but just regular batteries, if you let it go down to zero, it will start to leak also. So you don't want to let it go so low that it will leak.
Oh, that's interesting. We had a comment from Natalie saying, I killed my old laptop battery by keeping it inside and plugged in most of the time. Yeah, I had that happen as well. And fortunately, it was a laptop that had a changeable battery. And so for about $80, I was able to get it back in working order. But most laptops nowadays, I find that you actually can't change the battery on it without a bit of surgery on your computer, and in some cases it can be really, really difficult to replace the battery.
Unless you're an iFixit guy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you see what the iFixit people go through sometimes, and even they start destroying equipment sometimes trying to get it apart.
Well, unless it's Apple, it's usually for most laptops, it's fairly easy. If they have screws on the back, it's easy, I should say. But then if they don't have screws on the back, you got a problem.
Yeah, that's right. And if anybody's interested, Tom posted in the chat to retrieve a stolen bike, register with, and the Google Store app that is available there. So as per usual, we will have the audio as well as the deck will be posted on the Q&A section of our website later on tonight in all likelihood if Alan's past history comes to bear on this. Let's ask for a last call for any questions or comments. Before we close it off, we're coming up to pretty close to an hour. So everybody keep an eye on the chat. Tom just posted another link. Natalie, anyone know of a place to buy an old laptop battery that I can trust? I would not buy an old laptop battery. If you wanted a replacement battery, I would buy a new battery. Otherwise, you're just buying into something that has almost by definition not got full life to it.
I think in a previous Q&A, we had a discussion about batteries and replacements, and there's probably a link there if you look for it.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes the battery may be good. It's just that the old computer that someone had died for some other reason, and the battery is still good.
It could be, but it's really hard to tell.
Yeah.
So I personally wouldn't want to buy into something that I'm not absolutely certain is really good. So.
And, of course, a lot of the places that used to sell used equipment are not around anymore.
That's true, yeah. Okay, I think let's call it a night then, folks. So thanks very much for everybody sticking around for Q&A. It was quite lively tonight. I think that was really great. And again, as Alan pointed out, if you have any contributions, send them into suggestion box at opcug.ca.
And I've got two more slides.
Oh, yes, that's right. Sorry. Alan, carry on. I always forget this part.
Yeah, okay. So I was going to have Linda talk to this, but I think she failed on us.
She called me and said she didn't realize that it was at the end of Q&A, and she wasn't hanging around that long.
Okay.
So she just wanted me to point out the sort of things that she's going to be covering off in this. She'll be talking briefly about the way that the cameras actually function, in particular differences between mirrorless technology and digital single-lens reflex cameras. She'll be talking about things like depth of field and how you can control that in order to give artistic effects to your photography. She'll be talking about how to take effective people pictures, and she'll also be talking about where cell phones are good for taking pictures, and a lot of people poo-poo that in terms of it's not real photography, but that's really not the case, and there are many cases where cell phone is actually the ideal camera to actually use. So that'll be on Monday. You have to register for it. You will get a link from Eventbrite in order to join that particular session. So next Monday morning, 10 a.m., if you want to learn more about basic photography.
Okay, and finally, next week is our next Q&A, the 16th. And as Chris said, if you have any questions or items that you want to share, send them along to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And that's it for us. Thank you very much, everyone, and good night to you all.